You're listening to part 2 of episode 635 of Unwelcome Guests, Apocalypse Postponed. We turn our attention from population to money. This short talk by Tony Greenham is from a TEDx event in Leiden in 2012.
Well, we all use money, don't we? We all use money. And money, you could say, dominates our society, in fact. It shapes our lives. And I studied economics at school and at university and then another university. I never found the answers to certain questions that we never really think about too much. And I want to explore these questions with you now, today. What actually is money? Where does it come from? Who creates money? Now, you've heard a little bit about this, but we're going to go deeper into it now. I never found out the answers by studying economics. In fact, those questions weren't even asked. So then I trained as an accountant in the City of London. So I learned how to count money, but I never learned what money is. Then I became a banker, so I raised money for companies. But we never really questioned where that money had come from in the first place. Now, I became disillusioned with the banking system. Maybe a feeling that some of you share. And now I'm an economist that looks into money and banking. And I'm going to argue today that the essence of money, in fact, is that it is a social relationship. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, to begin to illustrate it, I want to tell you a story, a true story from London a couple of years ago. May 2010, there's been a general election, so we've got a new government. And that means we have a new chief secretary to the Treasury. He's the deputy finance minister in the UK. He comes into his office on the first day in his job, and he finds a note left for him by the previous chief secretary to the Treasury. That's nice. So he picks up the note and reads it. "Dear chief secretary, I'm afraid there is no money left. Good luck, kind regards." Well, this is a strange statement, isn't it? I mean, it's strange in a number of ways. It's strange because how can a country run out of money? The government then was spending £700 billion a year. That seems like quite a lot of money to me. But no, the reason why I think that's strange is because the best way to think about money, I would say to you, is as a way of exchanging value. It is a way, a mechanism for matching the incredible creativity that humanity has with our unmet needs and aspirations. How can you run out of that? Well, that note from the chief secretary, that shows a sort of powerful misconception of money, I think, that really has taken root. It's a conception that's a bit like this. That money is like gold locked in a vault. Now, of course, money is used to store value. This is a way that money is used. But this limits our thinking. This creates boundaries because this actually conflicts with using money to exchange value. It puts boundaries around our ability to use money to connect those spare resources and creativity with those unmet needs. But history tells us that the essence of money actually is in the exchange of value. The historian Niall Ferguson once said, "Money is not metal. Money is trust inscribed." And so I can illustrate that. You'll probably see quite a few of these today. So this one is quite interesting. This is a £20 note, and it has something quite curious written on it. It says, "I promise to pay the bearer on demand, the sum of £20 from the Bank of England." So, if I go to the Bank of England and I turn up and I say, "Okay, I've come to collect my £20 now," what are they going to give me? They'll give me another one of these. So, where's the £20? Where's the money? Okay? Well, the money is the promise. That promise is the money. Money is a social relationship. Now, this is a very empowering thought, that money is a social relationship, because it means that money should be a mechanism that helps society meet its goals. And we have some major challenges in this century, the 21st century. We have to find a way to help 9 billion people live together in peace and prosperity, fairly and equitably, within our ecological means. And I don't think our current system of money is up to the job. We need to rethink money. We need new kinds of money. So, before I explain why the new money is what we need to just cover this point, answer this question. One of these questions I mentioned, where does money come from? Well, people generally tend to think it's maybe from the central bank or the government, but actually in modern societies, maybe 97% of the money we have is created by private banks. You've already heard this. I'm going to demonstrate to you how this works, because people find this quite surprising. Why would we leave the creation of money in the hands of private banks? Well, this is how it works. And actually, by the way, in case you don't believe me, here's a quote from the governor of the Bank of England, who I hope understands how money works. He said, "When banks extend loans to their customers, they create money by crediting the customer's account." How can that possibly work? Works a bit like this. Imagine that I'm a bank. Here I am. I'd like to give you a loan. You sign a loan agreement. You promise to repay me the loan, 10,000 euros. That's great. So I've now got an asset. The customer has given me an IOU. What's the customer going to get in return? So if I'm the bank, do I take 10,000 euros from another customer's account, out of his account, and give it to this? No. No, nobody loses 10,000 pounds. So does the central bank give me 10,000 euros? No, the central bank doesn't create that money. I simply create it myself as the bank. And there it is, personal loan, bank statement. I've just credited to your account. I've created that money. This is another IOU. This is an IOU from the bank to the customer. But this is a very special kind of IOU. This is money. This is accepted as money. Now, you might say, well, okay, that's the system. Does that matter? Well, it does. It does, because this system has shown itself to be quite unstable. Because banks, this is a system where banks are driven primarily by profit. Yes, there are ethical banks. There are banks that do things differently. But the system, and this isn't to blame bankers, by the way, the system is driven by short-term profit. And that means that the money that's created is blind to social and ecological needs. It can leave whole regions and communities behind. The system creates too much money during booms, too little money during a crash. The system is inherently unstable. And so we can get booms. We get property booms. We even get tulip booms occasionally. We can have too much money created for the wrong things. Is this really the sort of best system that we can have? Well, no. And, you know, this isn't the way that the system has always been. Here's some examples of ways in which money was created without using bank debt money. There's the engravings on this cuneiform block from ancient Mesopotamia show that the recording of credit, of loans, of relationships was made by palaces and temples way before metal coins or banks. And the wooden sticks were used in Europe. These are called tally sticks. The government used them to buy goods and services. The people used them as money. They circulated. And then the people paid them back to the government as taxes. Money created without debt, without interest, without inflation, without banking crashes. It was used in England as late as the 19th century. And in the 20th century, governments were still issuing their own notes. This one's called a Bradbury bill. Not by a bank, issued debt-free by the government to finance expenditure. So, am I arguing to you that we should take the power of creation of money away from banks and give it back to the government? Well, this has been argued, and in fact, in the 1930s in America, most economics professors in the United States suggested that this should be the case. But there's a couple of problems. I'm not sure that people these days trust governments much more than they trust banks. And there's another problem. We can't wait. We can't wait for governments, and we can't wait for the banking system to change itself. But fortunately, there's still another way to create money. You're going to see lots of these notes today. People can create money because money is a social relationship. So wherever there are unmet needs, wherever there are spare resources, wherever we can use our creativity to put these two things together, we can find new ways of exchanging value. We can find new ways of creating money because money is a social relationship. And this is happening not just in history, this is happening around the world, right now. We're going to hear lots of stories later about this, from Greece to Germany, Brazil to Argentina, America to Australia. Wherever there are unmet needs and wherever there are spare resources, people are finding a way to put these two things together. And so we have money that's based on time, money based on hours worked, money based on mutual credit between businesses, money that is based on just a local area to revive an economy. We have money that can meet social needs, money that can meet environmental needs, money that can also stimulate the economy. Lots of different kinds of money. And to illustrate how this can happen, there's a couple of stories that I want to share. One from the Great Depression in the US, it's already been mentioned. Times were very hard during the Great Depression. One in four of the workforce were unemployed. People were going hungry, people were homeless. The system of bank debt money creation had gone spectacularly wrong in 1929 with the Wall Street crash. So perhaps it's not surprising that by 1933, there were 400 towns across America who had issued their own money. And this attracted the attention and support of the most prominent American economist of the time, Irving Fisher. Thought this was a very good thing. Perhaps a smaller story from the island of Guernsey in 1815. They had similar problems. They had an economy, they had infrastructure that was crumbling, and they had trade had fallen away. But the government was heavily indebted. It could barely cover the interest payments on the government's debt of the island. The market house needed to be rebuilt to re-encourage the trade. So what could they do? They couldn't borrow any more money. But the governor said, well, have we got timber? Have we got stone? Yes, we've got plenty on the island. Do we have carpenters? Do we have stonemasons? Yes, they're all unemployed. They've got no work. Well, how can we not put these two things together? Let's issue our own money against ourselves, rebuild the marketplace. And the trade that was generated repaid all the money, but it was issued by the people themselves against themselves. And we can do this. So do any of these things sound familiar, I wonder, from these two examples? We've got banking crashes. We've got credit crunches. We've got infrastructure. We have a huge need to invest. We've got people unemployed. We've got people who are hungry even. Do any of these problems sound familiar? I think they do. And so the question is, how can we start to put these people to work? How can we start to get the spare resources that exist to start to do the jobs that need to get done? Because the money debt system that we have, where money created by banks, it might have been very useful at certain points in time, but right now, it's not getting the job done. We need to rethink the way that we talk about money. We need to liberate ourselves, I would say, from the bank vault. We need to move from a money system and banking system that's dominated only by very large banks, by global banks. Okay, we need some of those, but what we really need is we need grassroots innovation from the bottom. We need financial innovation amongst communities. We need also smaller banks that can do different jobs. We need different kinds of money to suit different kinds of circumstances. Because what we've found through history is that when the system is only dominated by this bank debt money, what happens is the money is accumulated more and more amongst the wealthy, and the poor accumulate only more and more debts. And when this happens, you will always get a crash. So how do we liberate ourselves from this? Well, you're going to hear lots of examples later today about the way that people are beginning to do this. But the key is to understand, is to reestablish our idea of what money is. Because money is not metal. Money is trust inscribed. Money is a social relationship. And that means that we can control money. We mustn't let money control us. And so this is a very good piece of news. Because what it means is that as long as we have creativity in our communities, as long as we have trust within our communities, then we can never, ever run out of money. Thanks.
And thank you to Tony Greenham for that recording. We conclude with another speaker from the Socialism 2012 conference. This is Jason Farbman presenting a nuanced analysis of the social function of NGOs, with a particular emphasis on money, and his talk is called "The Revolution Will Not Be Funded Beyond the NGO Industrial Complex."
Those are the talks that we usually give in the ISO to kind of get our politics out there on campuses. It's a one recruitment tour or another. And one of the statistics that's been coming up year after year in those talks is this idea that, especially for younger generations, 50% of people, when polled, think capitalism is a fine system, and 50% don't. Right? And I think that that's been expressing statistically what we're starting to see in reality, which is that there's this widespread kind of unease or antipathy towards capitalism, but not without actually having any strong sense of what to replace it. Most people are against capitalism because it's clear that the world it's produced is terrible, but they don't have a strong idea. It's not like they've met a Marxist or a socialist. It's not like Marx's ideas pervade the mainstream or actually are anywhere out there. So this is kind of looking around the world and seeing what capitalism has produced, and it's kind of this gut reaction to the profit motive. So I think that when we talk about non-profit work, we have to separate a bunch of different things out. But I think it's important to think about the kind of people that are attracted to non-profit work in this moment, when a whole bunch of alternatives actually aren't readily apparent, when the left hasn't won anything in quite a while that's with a clear victory. So strategies and tactics is actually quite an open question for a lot of people. And so there's a lot of different talks we could give about different nonprofits. There's bunches of horror stories out there. I mean, a lot of which I'll tell, and a lot of which I'm sure a lot of people want to get out in the discussion. But kind of instead of just shitting on nonprofits the entire time, I want to actually talk about try to suss out why it's not a revolutionary strategy. I want to try to think about the people who might be attracted to nonprofits in this moment, because these are the kind of people who are coming to Occupy encampments. These are the kind of people who are coming out for all the right reasons, and because we don't have strong victories to point to, may go maybe pulled in one direction or another. So instead of most of the talk is negative because there's lots of things to say about it. But I think it's not just a matter of putting the good and the bad in different piles and seeing which is higher in terms of evaluating strategies. It's actually about figuring out what is our goal and how do we most effectively get there, right? And I mean, if you're at this conference, I'm taking it for granted that we all take as a goal socialist revolution, that we want an end to capitalism and not an accommodation with capitalism. Although I think that's a strong current within nonprofit work is, most of the strategies that have emerged under the neoliberal era is more of an accommodation to this kind of sense of powerlessness that people feel than an actual challenge of it. So it's not like we're developing, horizontalism, for example. We're not developing strategies that, take on power because we think we can win. We're trying to actually operate in the margins, right? So we want to try to, provide social services, etc., to people that are destroyed by capitalism because we don't have the hopes that we can actually take power for ourselves. So how do we go through the limitations of that of that whole world, the nonprofit world? And that's the kind of stuff that I want to talk about. The first thing I want to start with is why, or I guess a definition would be good. A nonprofit organization is an organization that uses surplus revenues not for profits or to distribute dividends to shareholders, but to achieve goals or to self-perpetuate, to keep the organization going. And there's all different kinds of forms of that. There's foundations, which generally distribute grants. There's service-based organizations, NGOs. And so I'm going to be talking a lot about foundations because that's where the people that distribute the money, that's where the control comes from a lot of the times. And the first question I think we want to go over is, why do billionaires give away tons of money to to social projects or to ostensibly a revolution that will throw them out, right? It's important. There's a book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, that I work from a lot. There's a lot of really good statistics in here. They're a little bit old. Most of them are from the turn of the century. But it's really good to try to get an idea of what the motives are, because there's a lot out there. We hear a lot about how the enlightened billionaires, I think, is how Ralph Nader put it. And it's very confusing about why this happens, and it gets the idea that maybe some people have good ideas, some people have bad ideas, and that's just how we have to orient. But it's worth saying that, foundations, while they do a tremendous amount of good, are also massive tax havens. tax law in the United States says that if your net worth at death exceeds $2 million, then half of that goes to the state. So if you have more than, if you have $4 million when you die, $2 million goes automatically into the state. And this is the death tax that the right is always carping about. So if you're worth $200 million, the U.S. Treasury will actually get $100 million on your death. However, the U.S. law states that nonprofits, in order to get 501c status, you only have to donate 5% of your assets every single year to some form. You have to spend it in some way. So if you have $200 million, you can die and give $100 million goes to the state. And then, you know, ostensibly to social welfare programs, which is, of course, anathema to you. Or you could create a foundation in your own name, and then $5 million that has to get spent on something, right? So, I mean, this is an easy sell for a lot of people. It's $5 million or $100 million that you're losing. And it's worth saying also that, you know, I mean, it's a tough thing because when we talk about, like, soup kitchens or battered women's shelters or, you know, all of these services, these are, of course, necessary and really important, and we shouldn't downplay that for a second or the work that's being done, because otherwise it wouldn't get done. But it is worth saying that the wealth that goes into this, that the money that goes into this is actually ours in the first place, right? The money that these billionaires have to give to the foundations was stolen from workers. Most of the people that we're talking about today are billionaires, you know, like Gates or Soros or, you know, the, like investment bankers or whatever. All this money is stolen from us in the first instance to put in their pockets, and then it's actually rerouted away from the public treasury into these foundations. So not only are they repositories of twice stolen wealth, but actually they take the control out of our hands. I mean, if for a second we assume that, like, you know, having a public debate on how taxes get spent is you know, a control, it's to some degree a control that we actually have. Putting it in the foundation hands where they're unaccountable, they don't actually have to explain why they're making any decision, totally, completely takes that out of our hands. And it's also worth saying that much of the actual giving that foundations do goes to alma mater universities of trustees, the opera, museums, things that the ruling class actually uses. I mean, it goes towards a whole bunch of other things, but it's quite a tidy arrangement when you can you know, put your money into this trust so you don't have to pay taxes on it. It goes to your alma mater so that you get a building named after you. And then oftentimes family members get paid enormous sums to serve on the board. This is not always the case, of course. But one example, which is particularly egregious, is the Annenberg Foundation. I don't know what they do, but Walter Annenberg, who is obviously a family member, gets paid $500,000 every year to be on the board, which is insane. And a Georgetown University study revealed that 64% of the 176 largest foundations and 79% of the smaller foundations pay some sort of trustee fees. They're not all insanely huge like the Annenberg Foundation, but the total payout in 1998 when Revolution Will Not Be Funded, the data comes from, was nearly $45 million that went to trustee fees, to paying people to make decisions about how to spend the money that was first stolen from us and then rerouted away from us in the tax base. So, I mean, I kind of want to leave it there for a second. I just want to put that out there to put in the back of people's heads as we talk about the other stuff, that, you know, that there's real financial incentive for people to donate to foundations. And as they've exploded in the period, which has roughly coincided with the neoliberal era, the money is just absolutely is enormous. And we hear, especially in this election cycle, we're hearing tons about money. When the Democrats failed to oust Scott Walker in Wisconsin, we heard a lot about how much he had spent. Walker is famously funded by the Koch brothers. People know who the Koch brothers are? So, you know, they, for people who don't, they've thrown money all over the place to push free market agenda, trying to slash budgets, trying to destroy collective bargaining, public health, or other social welfare services. For example, last year the Charles Koch Foundation pledged $1.5 million to hire new economics professors at Florida State University on the condition that the Kochs do the hiring themselves. That if the hire... If the hires don't meet the objectives set during the annual Koch evaluations, the money will get withdrawn. And the university agreed, it's both a testament to the absolute starvation that public schools are seeing. But as incredible as that one story is, it's not an isolated case. The Koch brothers fund similar projects at Clemson, Brown, Troy University, Utah State, and probably a few others. And that's millions of dollars that's going to spend money to develop ideological underpinnings for the next generation of capitalism. It's not a coincidence that it's the economics department. This is traditionally used by the right to like figure out like how do we create the next layer of bullshit, which we can actually normalize and sell what's happening. So speaking of money, we should talk about the gap in assets between conservative and progressive foundations. Conservatives have $1.24 billion in assets to the $7.945 billion in assets for liberal foundations. Right-wing foundations have give away a lot less than liberal foundations. Thanks. And so it's important to talk about, like, how is it that we live in a society totally dominated by conservative ideas, right? If the progressives have six times more money, why aren't we actually in a moment of incredible upheaval, right? Why aren't we throwing this money? It's like the way that foundations spend their money is actually profoundly different. Conservative foundations tend to spend their money funding intellectual projects, like what the Koch brothers do, to develop a comprehensive ideological framework, which allows them to present and win ideas and naturalize capitalism. But progressive foundations tend to give to narrower, issue-oriented, service-based organizations. You know, for better or for worse, they're stuck playing whack-a-mole. Every time the state recedes from another social welfare service, the left has to pick up the pieces and, you know, open a kitchen or a shelter or whatever. And so it tends to be narrow. I mean, I think there's other reasons for that, too. But grant maker Margaret C. Ayers of the Robert Sterling Clark Foundation was quoted in the Chronicle of Philanthropy as saying, "I don't see any grant maker who considers themselves progressives or liberals articulating what a progressive future would look like." And this is what I want to take a time to talk about these two different approaches, because I think this is really, really important. A helpful example is perhaps the Ford Foundation, his involvement in funding the Chicago Boys to institute the neoliberal program in the southern cone of Latin America. The Ford Foundation, for people who don't know, is a private foundation that was created in 1936 by Edsel and Henry Ford of the Ford Motor family. By 1947, the foundation owned 90% of the non-voting shares of Ford Motor Company. And later in the 70s, they wound up breaking off. But today, the Ford Foundation has assets of $10 billion and last year spent $413 million in grants, making them one of the largest givers. So according to the Ford Foundation itself, its grants are made for projects that focus on reducing poverty and injustice, promoting democratic values, and advancing human knowledge, creativity, and achievement. So in the 70s, the Southern Cone saw the rise of extreme free market neoliberal policies. This was outlined in the Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, if people have read that. So in many ways, this was actually sponsored by the Ford Foundation. They pursued a strategy that wasn't at all unlike the Koch brothers. They would go to Latin America, get universities to partner with them, and then send students to Chicago, to the University of Chicago, to study with Milton Friedman, to get steeped in free market ideology. The idea being that they could come back home, that they would win, you know, the people to their free market ideas, that they would become close with people in power and win them to the ideas. And the reason that this was the Southern Cone, or at least one of the reasons, is that, by the way, the Southern Cone is a region in Latin America that includes Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay. In the 1950s and 60s, when this program started, the working classes of the Southern Cone were on the ascendancy. They were fighting and they were winning. In some ways, stuff that was equal to Western European countries. For example, Argentina's 9% poverty rate was lower than France, and they had less than 5% unemployment. Uruguay had a 95% literacy rate and free universal health care for every citizen. I mean, we don't think about this in these terms after like neoliberalism finished gutting Latin America, but the economic policies that these governments were pursuing is known as developmentalism, which means it's a state-led and state-led economy in some ways. It's protective against foreign corporations coming in and looting that could derail that development. So you can imagine the kind of fits that this gives free market fanatics. So a grant from the Ford Foundation was used to create the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Chicago. All these students would come up year after year after year and then go back into Latin America in order to win people to these ideas, to try to sell the population on free market neoliberalism. The problem is that no one was buying. For two decades, Chicago Boys were totally marginal in Latin America in almost every single way. It was a time when working people were actually fighting and winning for more intervention from the state. They were conscious that they wanted that to happen. In the Chilean presidential elections of 1970, for example, socialist Salvador Allende was elected on a platform of nationalization of privately owned sectors of the economy. And then it took a bloody coup a few years later to drive him out when they realized that they couldn't win this democratically. They couldn't convince people to do this. So what happened was, like in Chile, country after country after country saw bloody dictatorship, where we see 30,000 people disappeared in Argentina, 3,000 murdered in Chile, hundreds kidnapped, tortured, and murdered in Uruguay. And it seems like a slight tangent, but in Indonesia, there was also a bloody coup, and the same kind of neoliberal policies emerged. And this is not a coincidence that these coups happen, these violent regimes come into power, and then suddenly all of these Chicago boys, or from the Berkeley School, which the Ford Foundation also funded, wind up in these positions of power, like the ministers of finance, or, you know, very close to the president, or whatever. And then very quickly, you see unionists, workers, leaders murdered, and then the policies of neoliberalism emerge, and this is kind of where it's born in many ways. And so, as the word started getting out about these, about the atrocities that were happening, I mean, it's hard to get into it to too much degree, but for instance, Ford at the time was still, the foundation and the car company were still closely related, but Ford was, the factories in Argentina were actually places where the killings would happen, or the Ford Falcon was a symbol of the junta. When the Ford Falcon would pull up, all of a sudden people would disappear and you'd never see them again. And if you were lucky, maybe you'd find the body at some point in the next few years. Like people, they would pull up to streets, yank people in, gone. From the workplaces, in one case that was reported, even from a wedding altar, where the people stormed into the wedding, grabbed the bride and the groom, and they were never seen again. They disappeared into a Ford Falcon. So, as these regimes are increasingly be recognized as bloody, terrible regimes, whose economic, basically underpinnings are kind of sponsored by the Ford Foundation, this creates a big problem for the Ford Foundation, right? And so they actually create a whole bunch of, or they give for the fund a whole bunch of organizations who are going to come down and investigate the abuses. And so it's really important to the Ford Foundation that, these abuses are going to come out, we have to talk about this, but it's really important that we actually not talk about politics, right? And so as we start seeing the separation, where we look just at the atrocities, let's just carefully catalog those, but we have no right to, this isn't a political thing, we should just talk about it. And it's worth saying also that Amnesty International gets involved at this point, and they have a slightly different motive for that same narrow focus, the apolitical focus, because they're trying to be objective, and they're kind of an organization of lawyers, and they're self-funded by lawyers. But what happens is two things. One, the front pages of all the newspapers across the world start broadcasting these atrocities, right? These organizations are responsible for saving thousands, if not tens of thousands, of lives. It's not clear at all to me that the dictatorships would have just stopped murdering people. So we want to say that first. But there is important limitations to the way it was covered. It was covered incredibly narrowly. So when Amnesty, if people have read Amnesty reports before, it tends to be a cataloging of atrocities, right? This person was, received electroshocks, this person was tortured, this is what happened, this is breaks this UN charter, and the government said it was because this person was a radical militant, but we can or cannot confirm that person was a radical militant. Right, and this is tends to be the extent to which the reports go. Right, but the reports never actually talk about why there would have been a need for a radical militant in the first place, or why the violence was happening, or why they've had to murder thousands and thousands and thousands of people to ram through these policies. It's really, really important to notice that, like what I was describing before about the ideological versus the narrow is happening right here, because they couldn't convince people to go for free market ideology, but they had spent 20 years developing these ideas, and they had people on the ground in place. Shit. Okay. So that when the shit hit the fan, they were ready to put this whole apparatus into place. They had a whole ideological structure. And then when the reporting came out, it saved lives and it won a Nobel Prize, which is right. But it also created some problems, right? Number one was it created this human rights discourse, which I think we see now. We can talk about that more in the discussion, but I think one of the things to say is that human rights tends to be very liberal in that it individualizes every problem. Did this person deserve what they had coming? And then what is the individual rights of that person and were they compromised? This was the moment where neoliberalism really came into being, and I think that it robbed the mainstream discourse, to whatever extent it was willing to talk about it, for an explanation of neoliberalism for a long time, which means that now, when we have a lot of these things that are very naturalized, that when Scott Walker is trying to attack collective bargaining, or it just makes sense that we would slash budgets while we're cutting taxes at the same time, like, this is naturalized. It's not clear, I think, to the majority of the population that this is a specific attack that comes at a specific moment that has all of these you know, things attached to it. So it actually came at a cost. And also, like I said before, it creates it puts the left on the defensive. While the right is constantly inventing new ideological justifications, we have to actually respond to the ideological justification. We have to figure out what they're saying, how to say it back. Then we got to play whack-a-mole, trying to, like, you know, care for the victims of whatever new, you know, new thing that they have come up with. And I just want to return to. I'll skip that actually. So the narrowing component is really important for foundation-funded nonprofit work in a number of other ways, and I'm going to try to go through this quickly because I've been talking a little bit too long. But Paul Kivel makes a useful distinction in The Revolution Will Not Be Funded between social service work and social change work. Which, social service work is work being done to take care of all the people that are destroyed by capitalism, which is like, you know, creating better women's shelters, soup kitchens, beds for the homeless, you know, all of these type of things. Social change work is what gets at the root causes of sexism, hunger, and homelessness. It would be a project like what the ISO is interested in engaging in. And Paul Kivel described his years of anti-domestic violence work in two ways. Like, one, it's incredibly, you know, you're providing a service that's much needed, and that means something. But at the same time, after years and years and years of seeing people come in and go out, and maybe the same people come back in, or maybe the same, you know, different people, it gets exhausting to think about. Well, is this an endless march of women or men or whatever that are going to come in here that are battered? Because the way the work tends to be funded is quantitatively, which is you know, by doing things that can be tracked and rated, like the number of beds you can provide, or if you can provide counseling or medical attention to this number of people, and the people who can do it most efficiently, most reflect like kind of a corporate ideology, get the most money. And so there's no one who's going to say this isn't valuable work, but there's rarely room or funding to pursue the structural solutions that keep women in domestic violence situations. So, for example, the money exists for things that you can measure, like beds, right? But persistent dehumanization of women, or pay equity, or lack of affordable housing and childcare, which actually keeps women in these situations, there's, you know, I mean, it's less clear how to deal with this, and there's less money for it, and which is actually two problems. So it's really not about, you know, what the work becomes about all too often is individualization of the problem, which is that it's either, you know, in the worst case, it's a woman who is too weak to leave, or something like this, or it's a man who is just an asshole. But it's not ever a social problem. It's not ever like a broader problem that we need to take on and talk about, like why sexism exists in the broader society. In a kind of related work, Sisters in Portland Impacting Real Issues Together, which is Spirit, they don't exist anymore, but they used to offer a host of services to like young women for like women's empowerment in Portland. And when when the organization disintegrated, the executive director wrote this, and it's a little bit long, but I just want to quote from it because I think it gets to the idea of like what the life is like in doing nonprofit work that you're also trying to do social change work. She wrote, "We were overwhelmed with the administrative steps required to become independent. We had to learn to set up accounting programs, a process for paying bills and spending money, legal requirements, insurance, liability, personnel policies, and payroll. A long list of administrative steps and documents were required, including hundreds of pages of legal credentials, bylaws, articles for incorporation. For purposes of staffing, we were expected to produce job descriptions, job announcements, a formal hiring process, and official methods of supervision. We needed letterhead, business cards, a fax machine, copier, printers, computers, email accounts, information packets promoting our accomplishments and successes. Most of our initial work moved us farther from social change efforts and toward nonprofit building work. We were never asked to articulate and demonstrate a political analysis that would guide our organizing work." Because, I mean, that's not particularly important in these cases. It actually winds up being just self-perpetuation. What a lot of people complain about when they do the nonprofit work is that they wind up coming in to make a difference, and that ability to make a difference, even in a small way, is often really hampered by finding yourself swimming in bureaucracy. This quantitative approach means a whole host of things for the actual work. It means that those people who can't or won't engage in this sort of like quantitative, results-driven planning see their funding disappear, and then you wind up not being able to do work. So this is this choice between playing the game the wrong way and not playing at all. It promotes a culture that's non-collaborative. When people are competing for grants, it's very difficult to imagine organizations having a collaborative relationship with one another, which actually would, by the way, allow one person to focus on social services, one organization on social change, or to do some sort of combination of that. It also actually affects the way we think about strategies in two ways. we start thinking about less about what strategies are successful and more where is the funding. And I've been in parts of organizations that do great work, but it's often like, now how can we frame this because we can talk to Ford and get this money or whatever, which is an important consideration. You can't operate without money, but the problem is that it forces you to tailor your goals to the money. The other thing is that it actually forces you into this way of justifying what you're doing, because you're constantly selling what you're doing. What we want to do is constantly be critical, self-critical all the time, and like, are we achieving our goals? Are we doing this? Are we doing good political work? And if there's no room to do that, if this is just room to this constant selling, then it just becomes a cycle of like, well, the funders want this, we're going to go after that, and then we're going to say that we did it better than anybody else, and then repeat. And the work becomes, it's really important that, like, you know, obviously we have a long-term vision of where we want to get. We're not talking about, you know, socialist revolution in the next fiscal quarter. But with nonprofits, funding work becomes compartmentalized. It's based on these year-long grant cycles or two-year-long grant cycles in which you have to constantly renew yourself. If you constantly have to stop and then have people done grant writing work in this room? Oh, wow, a few people. Okay. It's pages and pages and pages and documents and all this stuff. I mean, there's people at nonprofits whose only job is to write grants, right? And so, you know, this is a bunch of energy that essentially goes to self-justification. And behind all of this, which I think is actually probably the most significant thing and the thing that I'm not going to be able to talk about the most, is that all of this justification is going towards the board of a foundation. The justification isn't going to the community you're supposed to be serving. It's not, hey, how are things working? Are we, you know, are your needs being met? Do you still want us here? Or you want to help work? Do you want to have something to say about this? It actually becomes, you know, we're going to go into this neighborhood, and then we're going to ask Ford Foundation what they think about the work we're doing in this neighborhood, right? And the boards of the found, and who are these? Who are the funders? It's the ruling class. Yep. Boards of foundations look suspiciously similar to boards of corporations. They're 66% male, they're 90% white, they're not made up of teachers and plumbers and bus drivers, they're made up of bankers, executives, maybe sometimes doctors and lawyers, but the specific strata of people. And so, to actually find out what the community needs requires a whole host of strategies that seem totally impossible under this funding structure. Sometimes the endless, you know, descend into endless bureaucracy is this just an unhappy accident? I mean, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush and say that every funder is out to just shove us into a corner. But it's important to say that the way people fund and the way they expect people to work is in line with their vision of the way the world works, right? So if I made my fortune on business and results and quantitative, I'm going to expect other people to do that. But it's also important to say that because the ruling class is calling the shots in a lot of these cases, that really the ideological narrowing is, in many cases, a way to tamp down radicalism. This was certainly the case during the Black Power movement. Did people see Kianga's talk on Black Power to New Jim Crow? If you didn't, you should check it out. There's really a lot to be said about this. I think for us now, when we're talking about strategy and tactics in a moment of a left possibly reemerging in a real way, we really need to engage with what's happened over the last 30 years to the left, with where it went. And I think there's lots of answers to that. There's lots of answers to why people would come to like identity politics or see nonprofit or, you know, all these other things. But we should have clear answers for that, I think, that should inform the way we move forward. Black power, as people well know, was terrifying to the U.S. ruling class. It wasn't just because of some violence, although that was certainly happening. It was because as the struggle moved from the South to the North, there was a whole host of things that were being challenged that wasn't just formal segregation. Actually, there's, you know, it's actually a lot closer to, I think, what the new Jim Crow looks like in the North. And to see the kind of radicalism and calling the system into question that Black Power was doing was terrifying to the U.S. ruling class. And they were willing to kill or kidnap or frame people to break Black Power. The role of the Democratic Party is important. Those are all separate talks. But I think one of the things that often gets overlooked is foundation funding's role in that. There's a great book called Black Awakening in Capitalist America, which was written in like 67 or 68, so it's a remarkably prescient, but it like notes like these creeping trends, and actually looking back on it, it's great. The analysis is great. Just to go through very quickly, Black Power wasn't a homogenous movement, right? Not everybody agreed on everything, and some people disagreed, you know, quite strongly. There were more radical and conservative wings. The Black Power movement wasn't just the Black Panthers, right? There was a whole host of things going on. Even the question of power, Black Power, wasn't understood in the same way by everybody. For some, it clearly meant the control of taking society For themselves, all power to the people was a slogan. For others, it meant black business or black capitalism. And so then, as now, as usually, militants are less well organized than, you know, the Urban League, the NAACP, etc. I mean, it's just a matter of a whole host of resource questions. So money got dumped into the latter organization, the Urban League, the NAACP, by the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, all these foundations that, you know, are named after the filthy rich robber barons. Just to go through very quickly, in 67, the Ford Foundation gave the NAACP $300,000 and gave the Urban League $585,000. The Rockefeller Foundation then came back in with $650,000, and the Carnegie Corporation with $200,000. And then the Ford Foundation gave the Congress of Racial Equality, which was CORE, $175,000 in 1967. And so this group, CORE, is actually really important. It's a group that produced really militant-sounding rhetoric while advancing a revolutionary goal that actually looked was essentially black capitalism, right? So this put them on the conservative end of the black power movement, even though the rhetoric was actually, you know, revolution, revolution. So in 1967, CORE was desperately in need of money. They took the money. CORE could have gone in a number of directions, but where they wound up going was community control of schools and black business initiatives, you know, these kind of things about saying, let's get ours, right? You know, and then, which actually totally skirted the question of equity, because, you know, what we actually want is just this tiny minority of people to own businesses. But over the next 2 years, I mean, I can't get into everything, but over the next 2 years, the intensity of black power dies down as black men get elected to mayorships all over the country, and black power increasingly becomes associated with black business. What Robert Allen, the author of Black Awakening in Capitalist America, wrote was that CORE and cultural nationalists seek is not an end to oppression, but the transfer of the oppressive apparatus into their own hands. In 1969, after a lot of this had disappeared and CORE was no longer needed, grant foundations disappeared. CORE lost all the funding. The Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie Foundations, however, increased their grants to the NAACP, which is a much more conservative organization, the Urban League. In 74, the NAACP received grants from the three organizations upwards of $1.4 million. You know, this is a huge advance over what they had been getting, and the Urban League of $2.7 million. If people want to talk about that more, we can. I just want to give a few examples of the kind of ways in which this can happen. So the last thing that I really want to, the last kind of example I want to talk about is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. So I'm not going to talk about, if there's teachers here, they should talk about how the Gates Foundation is trying to destroy unions and teachers, but I want to talk about the involvement in Africa, because that's much less clear cut. You know, I think it's worth it going back and remembering some of the highlights of the Gates biography, the Bill Gates biography. In 2000, the U.S. Justice Department declared Microsoft a monopoly that aggressively and unfairly sought to crush any threats to its monopoly. Bill Gates at this time was widely perceived to be a robber baron on par with, you know, all of the great evil capitalists of all time, right? In 2004, the EU handed down the largest fine in European Union history to date, $794 million for anti-competitive monopolistic practices. In 2006, they were fined $450 million for noncompliance. And then, in 2008, were fined an additional $1.44 billion for further noncompliance. So basically, they were like this insane monopoly that continued and continued and continued to ignore injunction after injunction. So, in 2005, Time magazine put Bill, Melinda Gates and Bono on the cover of their magazine as the persons of the year. As these visionary people that would turn around, they said, if these people can give, now we all can, right? This was, by the way, just to recall, is the year after the $794 million fine, but with the $450 million and the $1.44 billion still a couple years off. So they're still entrenched in all of this stuff. And now, Bill Gates is regarded as a humanitarian with something to say about making the world a better place. Like, I think the Bill Gates PR turnaround has to be one of the most effective and expensive in world history. I mean, it's absolutely incredible how his reputation has been completely repaired. People forget now who Bill Gates used to be, or at least the media does. So Bill and Melinda Gates may be destroying schools, attacking teacher unions, refusing to fund abortions, but they're saving a lot of Africans, right? I mean, this is a tricky question I think we should talk about. They committed billions to fighting AIDS, malaria, and they spent almost $6 billion a year vaccinating Africans. They've saved over 100,000 lives. So again, you know, I don't think anybody's willing to be like 100,000 lives is meaningless. But I think we should talk about the cycle that keeps people in poverty in Africa. The Gates Foundation's Rollback Malaria, which has a virtual monopoly on malaria treatment, has for years celebrated the strategy they've used of pesticide-treated nets they've distributed to millions in Africa. But in Senegal, malaria has returned with a vengeance. And for a reason that actually experts have been warning about for a number of years, malaria is caused by a bunch of factors: climate, geography, housing, people's immune systems, population movements, a lot of societal, social, actually, causes. So one researcher was recently quoted saying, "I think the lesson of history is pretty clear that if economic and other conditions remain the same, malaria resurges when control efforts flag or fail." There is certainly growing evidence that this happens now. So if the structural conditions aren't changed in people's lives, then malaria is going to keep coming back no matter what, whether you put pesticide nets on them or not. And it's worth saying that now that they've had pesticide nets on them for years, the immune system actually is no longer prepared to deal with this resurgence of malaria. The failure to overhaul the structural conditions in Africa is not necessarily the Gates Foundation's fault, but the LA Times had a really great piece a few years ago on the Gates Foundation-funded polio vaccination clinic in Ibocha. I'm not sure if that's pronounced correct. Nigeria. I just want to quote from that. It says, "But polio is not the only threat Justice, a Nigerian child, faces. Almost since birth, he has had respiratory trouble. His neighbors call it the cough. People blame fumes and soot spewing from flames that tower 300 feet into the air over a nearby oil plant. The oil plant is owned by the Italian petroleum giant Eni, whose investors include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation." So the Gates Foundation may spend billions on drugs, but they spend many more billions investing in companies that cause the problems they're supposed to be fixing. They invest in petroleum companies, as I just mentioned, but they also invest heavily in pharmaceutical companies whose drugs are so desperately needed. And it's important to say that one of the things that the Gates was so known for was this rabid fixation on intellectual property, on copyright. And I think if there's anything that's killing people in Africa, it's the refusal to allow generic drugs in there. I mean, Gates, since 1976 at least, has been very public about this. He wrote a really shrill letter about copyright in 1976 called An Open Letter to Hobbyists, where he just kind of attacked people who were copying software, you know, like, you know, nerdy people exchanging discs for fun. And, I mean, it's obviously gotten much worse, but I think that this belies one of the main problems with the nonprofit industrial complex, which is the 95-5 issue. So, as I said much earlier, foundations are only required to spend 5% of their endowment every year, which means that foundations typically spend 5% of their endowment every year. The other 95% goes to a whole host of other things, but mostly to investment. The key thing is self-perpetuation. So what they wind up investing in all stock portfolios that could be a wide range of things. There's actually very few companies that have committed to saying socially responsible investments only. So it's not just a matter that we're funding one plant in Africa that's poisoning a few children. It's actually 5% of our money is going towards a whole host of different things. Well, 95% of it is going to prop up all of the different things in the world that make the world a shittier place. So it's not like an even trade. It's not even a qualitative difference. I mean, it's like Malcolm X said, right? You stick a knife in a man's back 9 inches and you pull it out 6 inches and then you expect to be told you're making progress, right? I mean, I don't think we can actually let them get away with that. The problem with the 95-5 rule is that not only is that a tax dodge, but the 5% doesn't mean that 5% is going towards poor people and spending. 5% means that you're spending 5% on administrative costs, on salaries, on money for your board. I think someone could still be really idealistic about nonprofits and say, okay, well, great, well, we should just talk to people about what they're doing. You know, this is terrible. But it's worth saying that the nonprofit has hired a host of lobbyists, the whole industry, to go to the mat to fight that 5% threshold doesn't even make it to 6%, that it stays as small as humanly possible. So yes, of course, they're saving lives, but they're going to go to the mat to protect themselves from actually having to give out any more. And I think it's clear that when you're spending 95% to actually invest in a host of corporations, it's not going to even be a fair fight. I'm going to wrap up. Sorry, I went a little bit over. I think it's worth saying that, like, in the 60s and 70s, which, you know, this moment that we all look to, like, the man was like, this was the idea. Now we're actually in a room right now because we have to arm ourselves with arguments that the revolution won't be funded by the man. I mean, we're in a different moment now. We have to talk about, really, frankly, why revolution's not going to come from the people who are causing the conditions that we need to make a revolution for. The heroes we're told to revere are enlightened billionaires. Like, think about the people that are held up as the most benevolent. George Soros, a hedge fund manager. Warren Buffett, a billionaire owner of multinational investment conglomerate. And Bill Gates, until recently the CEO of the world's largest computer company and a professional monopolist. So there's not doubt that they are committed to maintaining the capitalist system that made them filthy rich. They're not. I mean, you can hear any number of quotes from Warren Buffett that sound nice, but ultimately wind up getting you back to capitalism. It's like, I've been lucky, great, but, you know, more or less the capitalist system is fair. And so the strategies that come from the foundation funding reflect the ideas of those whose commitment to the capitalist system has made them filthy rich, right? Most of the rich think that they deserve their wealth, and therefore they deserve the control. That we're too stupid to manage our own lives and need a select community of geniuses to make decisions about our lives. And when we try to engage in behaviors outside the bounds of their comfort, the money dries up and our ability to continue the work disappears if we're reliant on that funding. Now, I just want to reiterate what the goal of the talk was before I wrap up. It's not to indict everyone who works for nonprofits, and I think we should be careful when we talk to people who work for nonprofits. I think there's all kinds of great work that does get funded by nonprofits, but I think it's when we make the mistake of confusing nonprofit jobs with revolutionary political work that becomes problematic, and that's what we want to take on. I think there's two related mistakes that people can make, that doing good work with nonprofit will make capitalism bearable, and that doing work with nonprofits will somehow allow us to destroy capitalism, that we're going to sneak it in and kind of work from the inside. Or it's actually as a product of just not having a strategical and tactical conversation over the last 30 years. Maybe there's just a haze. We need to draw these things out. Like, well, where are we going? What are our goals? And how does that inform our strategy? I just want to draw some parallels because I think the underlying principles of nonprofits as a strategy for social change isn't entirely unlike that of utopians, which came right before Marx, begging at the feet of enlightened aristocrats. It ignored the structural imperatives of the ruling class to defend their position at all costs and assumed that bad behavior is a set of bad ideas in people's heads and can be changed with the right appeal, right? The utopians believed that a really smart person or group of people could save society with a brilliant idea. Perhaps getting some funding from a benevolent aristocrat, and they could save all the helpless, agency-free, suffering people on their behalf. This is almost exactly what grants are in some ways. But we want to talk about strategies and tactics that are determined by our goal. We want an anti-capitalist revolutionary movement of millions of working-class people working together collaboratively across racial and gender lines. We want to see non-competitive. We want to see collaborative. We want to see creativity and independent initiative. We want to see people confident to fight at all costs, meaning they're not fearful or dependent on services that can be withdrawn. So I want to quote Trotsky real quick before I wrap up about strategies and tactics. And what he says about in order to achieve self-emancipation of the working class is that permissible and obligatory are those and only those means, we answer, which unite the revolutionary proletariat, fill their hearts with irreconcilable hostility to oppression, teach them contempt for official morality and its democratic echoers, imbue them with consciousness of their own historic mission, raise their courage and spirit of self-sacrifice in the struggle. Precisely from this, it flows that not all means are permissible. We spurn strategies which set one part of the working class against other parts, or attempt to make the masses happy without their participation, or lower the faith of the masses in themselves and their organization, replacing it by worship for the leaders. And there's many who use self-emancipation in all kinds of ways, including, you know, bootstraps. Revolutionary Marxists are the only ones that actually have the stubborn faith in working people to really believe that. And I think it's when the revolution comes to take back our wealth and to take back our world, it's not going to come at the permission of the rich. Thanks.
And again, I slightly edited that talk to fit it in and for clarity's sake to remove some of the repetition and the stuttering. If you'd like to download this show or any previous episodes, you can do so from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes, twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has given you some perspectives on a progressive future, and we perhaps cancel the apocalypse rather than just postpone it. I think we can. We change our vision, we change from combat to cooperation, we subdue the money god, start to see the natural world as more important. We emphasize our connection, our interdependence on one another and on the natural world, rather than attempt to dominance over it.
But that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle.